We'll move into a hearing on Senate Bill 623. We'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 623.
Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with the amount of payments that can be made by a cooperative corporation to deceased members of that corporation. Co-ops have a product that they refer to as capital credits or retains. In a non-co-op, that would be called profit. When their members die, they make distributions of those retains to the estate of that deceased person. Currently, they're limited to distributing $250. The Senate has raised that to $2,500, and there are amendments to raise it still more.
Thank you. Gary Bauer, John McCauley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Gary. Chair, members, committee, my name is Gary Bauer. I'm with the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and I'm hearing this morning on behalf of the 11 members that are telephone cooperatives. As your committee administrator pointed out, the cooperatives are required to pay its net proceeds of savings periodically to the members. This bill relates to the amount of capital credits or retains that a cooperative corporation may pay to the heirs of a deceased member. Under the current statute, any amount over $250 would have to go into a probate. And what we're requesting is that amount in the Senate, we requested that amount be raised to $2,500. As we were in the hearing in the Senate, a couple of the Senate members, including the chair and another member, recommended that we research going up to $5,000, that they thought that $2,500 was still fairly low. One of the reasons for that is that cooperative corporations, and these are folks such as telephone co-ops, electric co-ops, agricultural co-ops, you have a food co-op, et cetera, are not the only entities that have earnings. To share with you some examples I have in my testimony, the PERS system pays death benefits upon receipt of an affidavit without going through probate, and there are no limits. The state treasury, if you have monies on deposit with the state or with a state agency, they can do distributions up to $10,000. The same is true in terms of wages that are due an employee. In this case, it would go directly to the survivors. In terms of banks or savings and loans, they can distribute up to $25,000 without going through probate. So what we're requesting is
an increase.
I just ready to ask a question, but
okay, go ahead. We'll go ahead and finish them, Gary.
Request your support in allowing us to increase this amount. Thank you.
And with that, thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, I'm at your speed here. If we have a co-op, let's say we have an ag co-op, for instance, and an ag co-op is about to make a payment. Are we talking about one payment? Are we talking about a year's worth of payment to the person who's deceased? How does that work? Is it notification is made that a payment will be made? The person dies between the notification and the actual payment? Is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, as a member of the co-op, you have some equity in that cooperative. You also have the retains or basically the net proceeds or that are due to you. If those are paid periodically. If a member dies, the estate is due the net proceeds. So in this case, it's a payment to zero out that account.
Okay.
Mr. McCauley may want to deal with it from an agricultural viewpoint.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCauley, representing Agriculture Cooperative Council. We, too, support Senate Bill 623 and agree with the higher amount that was suggested to us by the Senate committee of going up to $5,000. Mr. Bauer, I think, properly answered Representative Atkinson's question. These are dollars that are periodically dispersed, and upon the death of a member of the co-op, they're now under this bill, if it were to become law, the amount would be raised so that a larger amount would go to the decedent's relatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to have this information about the treasury and wages and all that sort of thing. I guess I'd ask either them or the chair why we can't go to a higher figure. And I've managed a co-op for quite a few years, or not a lot of 8 or 10, but these retained earnings, what they simply are, they're the, as some of you, I know, chairs probably could well be a member of co-op, I'm not sure, but the retained earnings, that's the way the co-op funds itself. That's the equity that they, that's one of the ways they have the equity. And over, there's a large variance between the co-ops. Some of them are quite close in timeline in regard to paying out the retains. Maybe they're back 10 years. Some are back even less than that. Some are out 40 years. And it seems logical to me that we ought to put this as high as possible. I don't know what that, I was sort of looking at it. I see $25,000 for a bank account. Well, I can tell you this has become a bank account for many people, in a sense, it's a forced bank account. But they have not secured those retained earnings, had any benefit from them. And whatever we can do to keep them out of probate seems to me is a logical step. And you may have had some conversations, Chair, with other, as far as the dollar amount, but that's my feeling.
Mr. Putman, maybe as we have an amendment here to go to 5,000,
but I'm talking even
yeah.
Mr. Bauer, I think you told me of a number that was discussed in the Senate, the maximum amount that was needed last year. It was under 3,000, as I recall, and that's when the question came up, why not go to 5? Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putman, yes, and that was based on telecommunications cooperatives. Agriculture cooperatives may definitely have some higher gains.
Mr. Chair, I think that was one of the issues that kind of spurred the discussion in the Senate. Senator Starr also has, in his past career, affiliated with the cooperative and agriculture cooperative and recognized that there are higher payouts normally, or higher retains in agriculture cooperatives and probably communication cooperatives. And so that was one of the ideas that spurred a higher amount.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Button talks about the dollar amount and telephone might be one thing, but it's all over the book. I mean, there are some that are, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 that are on the books as retained earnings. I'll just say, I guess I've already voted. I have a conflict of interest, I suppose, potentially, because I do have earnings in a co-op, but frankly, it's been so long since I've paid, I'm not even sure what the value is. And I don't want to collect them because I don't want to leave right yet. But
okay. Rosen that. Then you have
that. My question was answered. Thanks.
Okay. John, when the issue of AgriPac, which is a co-op in the Salem-Woodburn area, when they went into bankruptcy, would this in any way at all affect that positively or negatively?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if it would have had an effect, because when they declared bankruptcy, those retained earnings, in essence, were at risk. And when the bankruptcy was, I guess, is still being finalized, but those members of that cooperative did lose that equity. Now, if someone would have, this would have been in effect, and someone have died before the bankruptcy was declared, then they, I think, would have had a right to those monies under the process established here.
But at the same time, I guess my concern would be to go, if we make this big, and I understand there are many farmers, especially farmers who have an enormous amount of money tied up in co-ops and equity, but if, let's just use an example, if a farmer was to die and he had $50,000 in co-op, and we took this number to 25 or 30,000, when you've got a co-op who is already teetering at the brink of existence, and if all of a sudden a death of one of its members causes an outgoing of $25,000 or $50,000 in cash, is it going to put the rest of the people's cash in that much more peril, which very well I could see happening if you go too high?
Mr. Chair, I would say the simple answer is yes, that's possible, although if a cooperative is in that tenuous of a financial position...
Which many of them are, I might add, right now, in the agricultural world.
Yeah, smaller ones, yeah, that could have a negative impact.
Would 10,000 possibly put them in the same situation if we were just to conceptually limit it to 10?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, it's hard to say because all of them are obviously different. I think 10,000 would be a comfortable figure. I don't have a problem with that. I don't think that it would have an adverse effect if one of their members died and they had to pay out $10,000. I just don't think that would be a big issue.
Mr. Chair, if I read the present statute correctly, you know, on line 5 of the bill, it says a coffee may pay the following. So it doesn't guarantee that the call was going to pay that. It's simply a matter of having an opportunity to pay this and keep it out of probate.
Good point. I'll go ahead and cut that. Any other questions of the witness this time? Witnesses? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We will close the public. Was there anyone else who did not get a chance to sign up and testify? You know, in the public hearing, open the work session on Senate Bill 623. Before us, we have the Dash 1 amendment that changed the $2,500 figure to $5,000. I think that they've been expressed by the committee members to go higher than that. I certainly would feel comfortable with $10,000. I understand that there is I know many farmers that have an enormous amount of money that are tied up in agricultural co-ops, and when AgriFac went by bankruptcy, I know farmers that were forced to do the same thing because that's where their money was, and they, you know, the agricultural co-ops normally give you a certain amount back every year if you retain it, if you've been a member for a long time, and that is enough to put farmers out of business. So I understand it's kind of a double-edged sword. I think we could go a little higher than even the $5,000 and not jeopardize the bank co-ops. Representative Gardner.
I was just going to make the motion to conceptually amend it to $10,000 as one has always liked to raise the Senate a little bit, you know.
Okay. Representative Eckland, before we get to that suspension of rules, things like that, did you have another comment?
Well, a question, procedural question. I'm a little bit nervous at 10, but if we were to go at 10, by the time we come back to concurrence, could these two individuals check to see with their representative constituents to see if that would have an adverse effect?
They certainly could, and then the Senate simply would not concur, I would think, and then we would have to go into a conference committee. I think that...
I don't want to mess it up. I'm just nervous about the real small startup, or maybe not startup, but the smaller co-op where cash flows can be tight.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess just for Reverend Atkinson's relationship to his comment, again, I'll point out that this does not require a co-op to do this. This only allows them to do that if they want to. So I see absolutely no threat to any co-op, any financial threat to any co-op. It just simply allows them to do that and allows the money to not go through probate. I think that's the bottom line. So I can't envision how any co-op would be opposed to, since it's not a shall in some way. That's my belief.
Representative Morissette, you had a question?
That's what I was going to mention.
Representative Morissette, you're aware there's a change in three places in the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the one on the back page, I believe you're correct in all three cases that they are may. Is that, John and Gary, is that your reading of the bill also? It's always a may. It does not require the co-op to pay the amount.
Mr. Chair, Gary Bauer, if you'll notice on the second page, I think it's line 10, It states that nor shall it be deemed or construed to impose any further obligations. And so, I mean, I think it is limiting. The other backup in the very first sentence on line 5 says, if authorized by the bylaws of the organization. So, again, I think if authorized and may give the co-op a fair amount of control over the distribution.
I agree, Mr. Chair. John McCulley, Agriculture Cooperative Council. I think subsection 5 on page 2 is pretty clear. It says that they shall not be required.
Mr. Chair, I would not support any figure if it was a shall. Because we're getting in the middle of telling some business how to run their business.
All right. Well, with that, the Chair asked that we suspend the rules for the purpose of conceptually amending Senate Bill 623 for the purpose of anywhere the figure $2,500 is. That number we changed to $10,000. Is there any objection to the suspension of the rules for such amendment? Seeing none, so ordered. We now have in front of us an amendment, a conceptual amendment of $10,000 rather than $5,000, rather than $2,500, excuse me, on line 6, line 18, on page 1, and line 12 of page 2. Discussion on the motion. Are there objections to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. We're now back with an amended bill in front of us, and the rules are no longer suspended.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 623 as conceptually amended to come forward with a big patch recommendation.
President Gardner moves Senate Bill 623 as conceptually amended to the House floor with a big pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Representative Lundquist, would you like to officially declare your conflict of interest?
Okay, I have potential conflict of interest if I have retained earnings in co-op.
Chair also would declare a potential conflict of interest having retained earnings in a co-op. Any others? Any other discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative
Hill? Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Marchette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Fire?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 623 moves the House floor as amended. Conceptually, Representative Lundquist, declare the bill. Thank you very much.
Who was that?
Representative Lundquist. We'll close the work session of Senate Bill 623. John and Gary? I ask you to check with your membership, make sure there are no objections to that, and if you find some, please get to myself and Senator Nelson as soon as possible. Thank you very much. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 359. Mr. Popper.
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that eliminates a requirement that people who rent airplanes to other folks, under current law, they have to disclose the availability of insurance and the nature of the coverage of that insurance. Testimony was received in the Senate that there's no effective way to enforce that requirement.
And Crook? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Ann Crook. I'm the interim manager of the Aeronautics Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation. This law was passed in 1987 that had the requirements that Mr. Putnam discussed, but since that time, we have been unable to adopt an administrative rule that would implement it. And though this is 12 years old, it was my predecessors and the aircraft rental industry and the aircraft insurance industry that had several problems with the requirements. For your benefit, I'll explain some of those requirements or some of the difficulties they had were, first of all, there could be a long chain of insurance policy owners. And that is because it's a fairly common practice for an aircraft owner to then lease that aircraft to a company that then turns around and rents it out for flight instruction or other use. And so the actual aircraft owner would have to provide notification of insurance, and then the company that actually rents the aircraft would have to provide notification. The insurance companies, and I attached the second page, is a letter that is from the administrative rule process in 1987 from an insurance carrier. I attached that because I think it's still a good example of what the issues were, that insurance is purchased by the aircraft owner and by the company that rents the aircraft, but it's not purchased by the renter. And without providing the renter the entire policy, they may be led astray by some limits disclosed on the proposed form without seeing the whole policy. There may be limitations on what they can do and what would nullify the entire policy, and as well as subrogation issues. And so in the rule writing process, it was discussed that the only way to effectively implement this would be to provide an entire copy of the policy to everyone renting an aircraft, and that was a problem for aircraft owners that thought it's their policy. They don't want to provide that to the general public, and just the people running the aircraft rental businesses said, well, that could be very huge, and trying to provide that to somebody all the time would probably lead them to instead just not have insurance, so that the easy notification would be there is none. And I don't think that was the intent of this law. So with those difficulties, and we have checked with everyone once again 12 years later to ensure that that these difficulties still exist, and in that time, I might add, there has been no one asking about this, we would like to just repeal the law.
Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Just one question. Why, rather than repeal the whole thing, just simplify the notification that you have to notify someone whether, in fact, you have insurance or don't?
Chair Byer and Representative Gardner, 12 years ago, we were unable to find a simple way to do that because there are different types of insurance, and it may be for the whole of the aircraft in certain instances, maybe for the person renting it, maybe not for the person renting it. And I believe they looked at that option of how to simplify it and didn't come up with a simple way to do it.
Mr. Chair, I still fail to see why you just can't simply notify them. You know, if I were someone renting an aircraft, whether in fact there was insurance that I was covered with or not, not all the rest of the coverage, handing a policy or anything, but just letting me know as a renter of an aircraft whether there is insurance or not. It just seems simple.
Chair Byer, Representative Gardner, we could do that, and I would just point to this letter from Regal Aviation Insurance that was concerned that that might lead a renter astray, thinking that they were insured when actually they got themselves into some situation where they weren't, and that would be confusing trying to simplify it to that point.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. I guess I have some of the same concern in terms of the liability. If you think it is insured and it isn't, is there some liability? But the other question would be, what's the common practice, if you know, of people who do rent aircraft? Do they usually provide their own insurance, or do they think somebody else is doing it?
Yes, Chair Byer, Representative Morissette, it's common for people who rent aircraft to provide their own insurance.
How common is it? I mean, is it a matter of course that people do that, and which makes this unnecessary?
I can't give you a percentage, but it's fairly common.
Thank you. I agree with Representative Gardner that there must be some middle ground where people are, at least there is a warning issued. I mean, just a warning saying this is something you have to be aware of. And it seems to me then that would call it to their attention. Thank you.
Mr. Putman, you have a clarification you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say to Representative Morissette, I am a licensed pilot. I hold a commercial rating. I'm in a club, and we carry club insurance. However, well over half the members of our club also carry their own insurance, for whatever that's worth. When I do have to rent an aircraft, I don't know if it's due to the law or due to the fixed base operator's own insurance policy, I sign a form indicating that I might or might not be covered by their insurance, and to be aware, that's there. The reason for it being there, I don't know if that's helpful to you.
May I respond? Yeah, that would be helpful. So is it required that you sign a form?
If I want to rent the aircraft,
then
that's their requirement of me.
Okay, that you are aware that they may not have insurance, is that what?
That's correct.
That's what I was getting at, then, some sort of a...
It basically says if you want to be sure you're covered, you better have your own policy. That's the essence of it.
Thank you.
Ben Gardner. Just one more quick question. I mean, my major concern is not with an experienced pilot who should know the system, does know the system, but mostly with those who are in flight instruction. Are they generally covered by insurance when they're in a flight instruction situation?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gardner, yes. Normally, flight instruction students are covered as one of the activities of that business.
Further discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 359? See, normal closed public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 359. Representative Gardner and Representative Marcette, you seem to have some concerns over repealing the statute.
I'm okay with it as long as there is some warning or some indication when you sign a lease agreement that you may not be covered. Yes. So there is no misrepresentation.
And I would agree with Representative Morissette, as long as, you know, those in flight instruction are covered, you know, lease agreement that is left an outline, I guess it is pretty much whatever.
Mr. Chairman, I just like the idea we're taking one law.
Yeah. I'm just disappointed it's not longer. Do you care to make a motion?
Yeah, I'll move that we pass Senate Bill, what is the number?
359
to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lunsford, 359 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Snell?
Aye.
Representative Lunsford?
Aye.
Representative Marquez?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Excuse.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 359 moves to the House floor to do pass recommendation. Let's take it to Representative Gardner. Carry the bill.
I would love to.
The session is closed. Okay, we will now go to Senate Bill 938. Public hearing on Senate Bill 938. We heard this bill last week. At that time, there were some questions Representative Atkinson had, but he could barely spoke out a word. He sounds a little better today. Do you have any further questions of the person, Representative Atkinson?
Nope.
Okay. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak on this bill? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing. Open work session on Senate Bill 938. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 938 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves Senate Bill 938 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion of the motion. I'd like to point out that at that time in the last meeting, I had said that I would take this bill to Representative Hill and ask his opinion. I feel he's our resident expert on electronic voting and electronic everything. He had a chance to look at the bill. He said the bill is fine. Pass it. Good bill. So for your information, for those of you who, as I do, respect Representative Hill's knowledge about this issue, that's his two cents for it. Call the roll.
Representative Lunsford?
Aye.
Representative Marquez?
Aye.
Representative Atkinson? Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative
Snell?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. I received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 938 moves to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Atkinson would like to carry this one. Volunteering from way off the side.
That's right.
Okay.
I guess
that's weird. That's insurance. Close the work session.
Around the block four.
We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 791. A public hearing. I think Commissioner Roberts is probably sitting outside. We'll let the proponents of the bill speak first to the bill. Mr. Putman, would you like to give us a brief introduction?
Oh, I thought you said you were going to let them speak first, but... yes, Mr. Chairman. This allows the local committees of apprenticeship councils to select applicants under specified conditions, and there also have been amendments proposed, which I have here and will pass out to the committee.
Thank you.
If you want them.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the independent electrical contractors and the associated builders and contractors. The bill before you today, Senate Bill 791, is one of our primary agenda items this legislative session and is an apprenticeship reform, which in the interim, as I traveled around the state meeting with contractors, one of the biggest concerns, biggest issues that I have heard from these smaller family businesses, it's a family business issue, it's an issue that resonates and basically what ends up happening, and it incorporates the same selection method process of apprenticeship. And just to give you a quick and abridged version of how apprenticeship works in the state, any committee can form on their own in any part of the state, and when they form, they have to put together the standards for their apprenticeship, meet the minimum qualifications of what is required, such as affirmative action, equal employment opportunity requirements, et cetera. They submit that to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Apprenticeship Training Council. Their program then has to be approved by the Apprenticeship Council. And at that time, then they can start, once it is approved, they can start allocating apprentices, which they're called apprentices with training agents. Training agents means the businesses. And there are several requirements. One of the current selection method process, when you go through that, there has been some instances where they have had exceptions. Exceptions being if you are a family member or if you are have been employed with the family business or business for 6 months and have been an employee of that business. The biggest complaint that we've heard in the interim is that there is no guarantee under the current process that as a son or daughter or a current employee that you can be allocated to your business. And so one of the bill before you today puts in place a mechanism for which would allow a family member, son or daughter, or a current employee to be allocated to that family business. I want to point out to the committee that you know, many businesses in the state of Oregon, especially in construction, are family businesses. They're built around the family structure. A lot of times you have a couple people in the electrical industry pulling wire. They bring up their son or daughter to help run the company. And so it is a family business. And what I've encountered is that most of them are family business. And not having the guarantee that they can bring their son or daughter to not only learn the trade, but to eventually take over the business. You build a business in the state, you want to see it continue to generations to follow. That's the issue here. And one of the many of our members have been disheartened to have a son or daughter sent across town to their competitor. And I've heard that in different parts of the state where there is no guarantee. And if they want to get in and learn the trade, they can be sent to another business. Because what happens is you're put in a random selection. Basically, you're thrown in a pool, and as you move up the list, then you're being picked by the training agent at that time. The process that you see, Senate Bill 791 allows, under certain conditions, and it's basically once you're eligible to enter the apprenticeship program, which means you meet the minimum requirements, such as in apprenticeship you have to have a C average, in the electrical industry you have to have algebra, a minimum GPA, all those things are set in place before you can enter the apprenticeship program. The employer has to be an approved training agent. The applicant and the employer both have to then agree in writing that they'll enter into this apprenticeship agreement. So under those conditions, then you would be able to
enter under your family business or a business if you have been employed for 6 months or more. The reason we picked 6 months or more is the way it used to be in the past. This was allowed, and many businesses have been able to, in the past, bring their sons or daughters in or current employees. Now, that has changed, and you have to go through, have to have that selection method approved by the council, and that's been our problem.
Sean?
Yes.
When did that change?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was about 5 or 6 years ago, and probably Commissioner Roberts will be able to address that particular change. But one of the things we've been working with Bureau on, and it's actually, and it was adopted in the Senate, in lines 5 through 7, we obviously there's an equal employment opportunity issue here, and that is a federal issue, and you must meet the affirmative action requirements and not basically create an adverse impact on race, sex, or ethnic group. So what we put in here is we put a protection where there's not going to be abuse by the local apprenticeship committee if the council determines that there is an adverse impact on race, sex, or ethnic group. So what we've done, and the amendments clarify that, clarify the intent of which we intended to for which the bill passed in the Senate. And instead of to the extent, the -A2 amendments replace to the extent with unless the training council determines that there is an adverse impact, then you shall allow the selection method to occur. And the reason why we changed that, and it was confusion on the issue as we passed the Senate with the Bureau of Labor Industries, and you'll hear from Commissioner Roberts concerning that discrepancy. But what we are looking for is you're innocent until proven guilty is the fundamental question when wanting to put this in place. When I mean innocent, we should be able to bring in these apprentices if we are not creating an adverse impact on race, sex, or any ethnic group. And this puts the burden on the committee to go through that process, and then still gives the protection and the ability for the Bureau of Labor Industries to look at each of those apprenticeship committees and make sure that they are not abusing them. And so we feel we have a good piece of the modifications allow us to do it. We're innocent until proven guilty. If we are, some reason, if there is a committee in the state putting an adverse impact, then take it away. That's not our intention of the bill. Our intention of this bill is to allow family businesses to still bring in their sons or daughters into the program, into their business, and current employees. And the reason why we didn't specifically talk about sons and daughters, as that is the fundamental concern around the state, is most family members have been employees of the family business for more than 6 months. And so we just narrowed it in and dealt with the six-month issue because most employees, as I talked around to different contractors, work in the warehouse, work in the storeroom. So they've been involved with the company for quite some time. So we would urge that you adopt the -A2 amendments and pass Senate Bill 791. You'll hear from others this morning, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gardner, the representative.
Well, a couple of questions. First of all, you're talking about this applies to sons and daughters. This says any employee, so virtually this could open it up to thousands that are, you know, friends, relatives, anybody that works for the company in the course of a material handler. If you have a large shop that has 500 employees and has 20, 30 material handlers, they'd all qualify, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, the big issue and is not with big companies, because big companies right now can already do a lot of these things. It's the smaller companies.
I understand your concern with the smaller companies. I'm just saying virtually this could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, this does open the door for and it does allow current employees to be picked. However, in business, when you find a good employee, and that's the key. When you find somebody who shows up on time for work, who has a hard work ethic, it is it,
is hard for that employer to lose that person when they want to finally get them into the trade, lose them to a competitor across town. And so in business, it's very difficult to be...
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could continue on with that one. You're talking about losing them to a competitor around town. Having had some limited experience in this area, I've always found it very beneficial that when apprentices spend, you know, in the course of a 5-year apprenticeship, spend an apprenticeship of at least 1 year with 4 different employers to be, you know, to get the experience of those various different employers, which would be beneficial for their family business, wouldn't it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, and that would be still available. If that's what they wanted to do under this proposal, you'd have to basically agree to want to do that. If the apprentice wants to go out and get more experience, this does not limit them from doing this. All this does is allows them, if, let's say, a son or daughter wants to enter the business, not only learn the trade, but then eventually take over the business, which happens more often than not, it gives them the ability to do that.
But a couple more here. But if they are eventually going to take over the business, just a couple things. First of all, they can go to that business as a journeyman, you know, in the case of electricians, as a journeyman wireman, take a call to that business after they've completed a 4-to-5-year apprenticeship, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, you mean after they...
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sure. And also, at least in the 5-year apprenticeships that I'm familiar with, in the 5th year, you have your choice of which shop you can go and work at, don't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I believe so. I'm not familiar with the entire steps, but yeah, I believe you're right.
I am at yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple more. Also, it says any race, sex, or ethnic group. Would that include white Anglo-Saxon males of European descent?
Representative Gardner, I believe so. That this language is actually taken from the federal EEO and was we were helped by Mr. Sims from the Apprenticeship Committee, Bureau of Labor and Industries, on this particular language.
Just one last one, I promise. You say, and you're changing line 13 to say meet minimum qualifications, right? So an applicant has to meet minimum qualifications. So if you have cases like I'm familiar with where you've got about 1,000 applicants for about 50 jobs, if the person meets those minimum qualifications and they are applicant number 1,000, but they met the minimum qualifications, they can jump ahead of, you know, virtually hundreds of other people who are more qualified than they are, can't they?
Mr. Representative Gardner, this would allow that exception.
Representative Morissette, you still have a question?
Well, you know, somewhere along the line, I'd like to know a little bit more about the apprenticeship committees in the Apprenticeship Training Council, but that's just general information, so I won't ask specifically. I would hope that would be
forthcoming by the other witnesses, maybe.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Burton or good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Burton Wiest. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. Our membership is made up of both union and non-union plumbing contractors around Oregon. The typical, with respect, if I may, to Representative Gardner's remark, the unfortunate part is that the typical plumbing shop in Oregon is not 50 or 100 or 30. In fact, the typical plumbing shop is closer to 4. People involved in that shop. I'm the son of a plumbing contractor in Brookings, Oregon, who apprenticed, I don't want to tell you how many years ago, while I was going through college. And I can tell you, if I would have had to go out of town, since we were the only plumbing shop in Brookings, Oregon, if I'd had to go out of town to apprentice, and I'd had to go into another county or another city or another area of the state to work as an apprentice, it would have been an extreme hardship on my family and would have made the decision for me on whether or not I would have stayed in that business. And that's unfortunately the situation we have. What this bill is about, it's not about discrimination. It's not about moving people ahead of other people. What it's about is whether our industries, which are heavily regulated and heavily controlled in terms of apprenticeship, are going to retain the ability to pass our businesses on to our sons and our daughters. And it's that simple, because the majority of us are not big contractors, union or otherwise. We are small hometown contractors spread out all over Oregon. In eastern Oregon, there's parts of the state, in one area we have one plumber to serve three counties in eastern Oregon. We want to make it state policy that we have the ability to pass our businesses on to our sons and to our daughters. Second half of this deals with the issue of discrimination, because we have to talk about it, because I think Representative Gardner correctly and accurately pointed out an issue here. We have tried to make this bill so that the Apprenticeship Council, if discrimination results as a result of a policy or an Apprenticeship Council that is using this method, then they have, we wanted to make sure they had the clear ability to take that program away or take this selection method away from them, and we feel the bill does that. I would also add to you that our experience in the plumbing industry has been that we get the minorities and women that actually stay in the apprenticeship program more easily if they've been employees, if they understand what the business is and what it involves. Often you get people that don't understand plumbing isn't, plumbing's a lot of confined spaces, dirty areas, and a lot of septic tanks and that kind of work. Plumbing isn't very much new construction, all nice and clean, and that the overwhelming majority of plumbing involves dirty work. And we have found that when people have spent some time in your company and they understand what they're going to get involved with in plumbing, they're the people who stay, female and minority alike. They're the people who stay in the program and graduate. We think there's just too much emphasis on numbers. Generate the numbers. But when you follow them through the program, you find they drop out. So we're comfortable and confident that we can provide excellent minority and female opportunities with this selection method made available. So what we're asking is for the state of Oregon to reaffirm or to affirm the policy that we ought to be able to hire our sons and daughters to work in our business in our own communities and not have to send them off to other parts of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Trish, you have anything else to add?
I do. Thank you very much. Trish Conrad on behalf of the Oregon Apprenticeship Coalition. The OAC represents more than 40 committees currently training over 3,000 apprentices from across the state. There are both union and non-union programs involved, and we have a pretty good geographic representation as well, ranging from Southern Oregon to Lane County to the city of Portland. When I was last here addressing this committee, we were talking about HB 2879. That certainly isn't an issue today. But as a matter of update on that issue, we'd asked this committee not take action at that time because we were seeking remedy through the administrative rules process. We wanted to let you know that we were able to seek some resolution of those issues through the communication and cooperative efforts from Commissioner Roberts and Agency Director Stephen Sims, and wanted to thank them for that and update you on that issue. However, we were not able to resolve all the issues regarding the administration of apprenticeship in Oregon through that process, which is what brings Senate Bill 791 before us today. This bill received unanimous support in the Senate Business and Consumer Affairs Committee and nearly unanimous support on the Senate floor. It is involving some of the most fundamental issues about employment and businesses in this country, as you've heard from both Sean Miller and Burton Weiss. In fact, apprenticeship is something that is so widely accepted in this country, you need look no farther than Walt Disney's movie, The Wizard's Apprentice. So you may be asking yourself, what does Mickey Mouse have to do with this bill? Absolutely nothing. Which is the same level of relevance some of the comments made by other parties and other hearings have to this particular issue and this bill. And we would hope the discussion today would be focused on this particular legislation and not any personal comments or other discussions about matters not appropriate for public discussion. Now, when you look at affirmative action, it's kind of an interesting topic. It's something we hear a lot about, and it's one of those, you love it, you hate it, or you know nothing about it. Well, I guess from time to time, maybe you're also all three. I certainly wasn't as familiar with apprenticeship or some of the labor issues as other people involved in this issue when I first began working with the Apprenticeship Coalition. So I went to the source, as I like to do, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. When I looked at the apprenticeship website for BOLI, I noticed that they claimed that they had over 11% participation by minorities in their programs. And they said also it was more than 5% that were women. Now, if you subtract the 5%, assuming it's added in twice, you still end up at about 6% minority participation. Well, what I did is I looked at the most recent census data for the state of Oregon to look at what our total minority, be it race or ethnicity, population is. It said we were at about 9%.
I would challenge pretty much any profession to almost equal the numbers of both participation in a program and general population. But more importantly, the authority of the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council is pretty high in comparison to some other states which have kept affirmative action at the federal level. We're certainly not suggesting that that change here, but merely that that authority be tempered by a reasonable burden. There was no opposition to this legislation in the Senate, so we can only assume that the opposition is coming before you now because of the -1 amendments presented today. Probably the most opposition is going to be caused by that shift in burden. However, we believe it's an equitable and just burden, and as Sean stated previously, only says that they are innocent until proven guilty. They would prefer that the committees be forced to prove the future and that the council not be forced to prove the present. We think that's unfair. Of course, life isn't fair, but, you know, we try to do our best, and I'm sure that you do too. The only concern that was voiced, I guess is the appropriate word to use, regarding affirmative action regards to this legislation from the governor's affirmative action officer, according to Stevenson, the agency director, came early on in this session, and there's been no opposition since. Then we would have to look at perhaps even other people in this room. Though they shall remain nameless, I've had extended conversations with other people in this room who have talked about extensive efforts made to include minorities and women, minorities being either by ethnicity or race, in programs. And oftentimes, they do get some numbers that start the program but don't necessarily complete it. So I think what we need to look at is there a problem? Well, not if you look at the straight numbers. And even if there is a problem, is it because people aren't trying or because necessarily maybe they're not successfully completing the program? And I think that's perhaps an issue you'll need to look at in making your decision. Finally, I'd like to address a couple of things that came up in terms of the discussion even today. There will be some arguments made, I suspect, that in order for an apprenticeship to get good training and have a good experience, they need to work with different programs. Well, that's sort of like saying a child can't be educated appropriately unless that child changes school every single year. Yes, people can get good training. If it was such a problem in the past, I suspect perhaps someone would have come forward and said, well, let's institute something that has them change their programs every year to get better experience. And finally, the issue of minimum qualifications. It was said that this could potentially mean that someone could jump ahead of someone else with more qualification purely because they meet the minimum qualifications. Well, I guess you'd have to look no further than affirmative action itself to find a similar example. So if affirmative action is the issue, and perhaps it proposes the same thing, we do not think that meeting minimum qualifications would cause any harm. And finally, to conclude, I would have to say that as a woman, I certainly would not want to be a plumber or an electrician, and frankly, we're probably all better off that I don't. But that also means that I certainly wouldn't support anything that would restrict accessibility and opportunity for other women in this state. And the Oregon Apprenticeship Council urges your support of Senate Bill 791.
I may add a question.
Tricia, you made reference to the dash one. We have the dash two up here. Did you?
Is it dash two?
That's two.
Oh.
This is the one you meant. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions of the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. Commissioner Roberts.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. In that capacity, serve as the chair of the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council. I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill, and I think that the amendments actually help clarify what the difference is between their view of what we should be doing and my view. But let me give you a little bit of background, because I do think there are concerns, the changes that we have made, that we are trying to address and that we believe can and are appropriately addressed through our rules and the policies of the Oregon Apprenticeship and Training Council. When I became labor commissioner, one of the things that I was urged from a lot of different sources was that we really needed to do something about apprenticeship. That apprenticeship system, as we had been regulating it in the state of Oregon, had become overly bureaucratic and had become too much of a status quo system. Shortly after that, there was a disparity study that was undertaken by the City of Portland, Multnomah County, and TriMet, which looked at the construction trades generally and tried to determine whether there were
fair opportunities for women and minorities. One area in which they looked was apprenticeship. And one of the most specific proposals in the entire report was that we eliminate something that was that we knew as selection method D. This is a, under the Federal Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training, there are certain selection methods that you can use, random, merit, ranking people by time of application. There are a lot of different ways they're accepted. And then they said you can also adopt any other method that enhances participation by women and minorities. And the others were called A through C, and D was whatever you decided to develop. What we developed in our state was a system that said once you meet the minimum qualifications, and it's your responsibility as a potential apprentice to go out and find your own job with a registered a training agent, and then we'll let you in the program. Administratively, this is very convenient and very easy to implement. The idea was that this would cut through the red tape and allow employers to reach out and get women and minorities. What the disparity study showed was that, on the contrary, this was a discriminatory system, perhaps not intentionally so, but the effect had a disparate impact on women and minorities. This was consistent with the decision made by the state of Washington several years before when they stopped allowing this method to be used at all. It's also consistent with the decision of a federal court in California, which ruled that this method is discriminatory on its face and therefore unlawful. When this report came out and when this evidence that we had, we felt there was no choice, and the Apprenticeship Council unanimously voted to eliminate that method. This created some difficulties, particularly for small committees that had not the same resources as the larger ones to try to get together a list and do that. But we worked hard. When we decided to make this change, we gave them a year's notice. We worked with them, and every one of our committees ultimately ended up adopting alternative methods of selection. In doing that, we said you can have, for example, a random system, but we will allow some exceptions. And among the exceptions which we have allowed from the beginning is that when someone is eligible to be placed in an apprenticeship program, if it's a family member, the family business has the first claims on them. Or if it's a current employee, the employer has the first claim on them. It doesn't mean they get to move to the front of the line ahead of anyone else, but when they're ready to be chosen, they don't have to go to a competitor. They can go someone. We made that option available to all the committees. Not every committee chose to adopt that. And many of the complaints that we heard over on the Senate side that have been heard otherwise are from people who happen to be enrolled in programs or committees where they don't allow that, even though it would be permitted by the council. This bill doesn't change that. This bill doesn't give the individual employer any more rights than they have currently. In fact, I think properly understood, this bill, and one of the reasons why we supported this bill as it passed through the Senate, and only when we discovered there were the differences in interpretations, which are now being clarified with these amendments, and we understood that there was perhaps an intent to use this to circumvent our process, we were grudgingly supportive of this because we felt it codified what was already our policy and practice. It is not our job to try to make it difficult for people to pass their businesses on to their kids. It is our concern that we try to avoid the reputation that construction trades have had for years, that to get in the construction trades you have to be related to somebody or you have to know somebody. And that in fact we want to have fair and equal opportunity for every applicant into an apprenticeship program. Now, part of what has driven this is the fact that we had a complaint filed against one of our committees, the Area 1 Plumbers JATC, because according to the EOC, their numbers were not very good, operating primarily in the Portland area where there's a higher minority population. They said their numbers weren't good, and they had been using this impermissible selection method. Because at that time, apprenticeship committees were still treated as agencies of the state, as committees, we were on the hook not only to defend them, but possibly if there were damages found to the state of Oregon to pay that. We therefore entered into negotiations, and this complaint has been settled. As a part of the settlement, selection methods have been approved for this committee. And the selection method that's been approved is basically one of a random selection method, but it includes exceptions, including exceptions that track very closely with what's in the Senate bill. But I want to read to you just a paragraph here that talks about that, to indicate that there are some differences between what's in that settlement agreement, what's in this bill. And my concern is that if you pass this bill, it may very well give that committee the feeling that they statutorily have rights that go beyond the settlement agreement could involve them in a lawsuit with us, could involve us, all of us in a lawsuit with the EEOC, and undermine what we're trying to do here. What this says is that employers who are registered trading agents with the sponsor, which the sponsor in this case is the Area 1 Plumbers JATC, and who have participated in the program for a minimum of 2 years, have to have been in this program for at least 2 years before this exception applies. That's not in the bill. And who have a minimum of 3 apprentices. So this argument here about the small companies only have maybe 1 apprentice, they're not even going to qualify under this agreement, that they have the ability at the discretion of the sponsor to promote to the apprenticeship program full-time employees who have been in their employee for a minimum of 6 months. And then it talks about that. And then it has the caveats, provided the training agent is actively working with the sponsor to establish an employer EO policy and has implemented and followed the other guidelines of JATC regarding the JATC's affirmative action plan. The reason I quote this at some length is not only because there's some disparities in the terms, but it's clear that this is an exception to the general rule. That's what we're doing now, too. We have a rule that says you have to use these selection methods. We'll authorize exceptions. But because it is an exception, this allegation that you're innocent until proven guilty doesn't apply, because you're asking for an exception from the general rule. Therefore, the burden is on the committee to show that they're in compliance. And that's why I think this notion that we have the burden as the enforcement agent to come in and prove that you're somehow not meeting your EEO responsibilities. And if you're a 3-person firm and you only hire 1 apprentice, I'd like to know how you fall within any numerical quota anybody can imagine. Because you either have 100% of a group or you have 0% if you only have 1 apprentice. We don't want to play the numbers game. We're trying to get away from the numbers game. We're trying to move towards a uniform, fair, objective, non-discriminatory selection method for everybody. And then the numbers turn out what they are. What we're trying to do really is to move beyond affirmative action to a true non-discriminatory system. We're trying to do that in a way that has some flexibility so that people who are trying to run a business and who are not interested perhaps in the broader social issues and should not have to be can know that there's a safe haven that if you use these systems, it's going to work and it's going to be fair. I believe that our apprenticeship council has worked hard and worked well. Putting this in statute, I believe, will give, at the very best case, will codify what we're already doing, and at the worst case, will give people the feeling that they have a statutory right to do something that is contrary to our policies as a state, contrary to the EEOC policy, will get us involved in a lawsuit, not only with the EEOC, but with our own committees, and that will undermine what we're trying to do to make sure this system works fairly. I would, after having worked with them and having gone through this and tried to go through language, I've reached the conclusion that it isn't a question of working with the language. It is a question of trust. They don't trust us, and I acknowledge that. They don't trust us to implement the law. I don't know that we entirely trust some of them to comply with the law. What we need to do is to allow the process to work. There's plenty of opportunity for input. There's plenty of flexibility in the system now. Writing it statutorily at this time during transition and to freeze into place a selection method that I believe is contrary to what the state and federal law requires is going to put us on a collision course that's going to be decided in the courts. And we don't want to do that. So I would strongly urge you not to pass this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Commissioner Roberts. Thank you very much for coming in today. Jerry? And Dick O'Connor? Is it Garland Hang? Galarno.
My name is Jerry Galarno, and I'm the training coordinator for Sheet Metal Apprenticeship in Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm also the spokesperson for the Union Coordinators Group in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Speaking of this disparity study that was done by the City of Portland, Chapter 13 actually was on apprenticeship, and they basically had nothing really good to say about apprenticeship. In fact, it was a good old boy network. We took great offense to this at the time, but with the Bureau of Labor and Industry's help and Steve Sims and Jack Roberts, we sat down and looked at this thing and decided what we needed to do rather than stand up and fight it. This is what a lot of this thing came through about doing away with selection method D and so forth. We've worked very hard to change our image. We felt that most of this stuff wasn't true to start off with. Right now, in the city of Portland and in Northern Oregon, we've worked very hard with Oregon Tradeswomen Network to get more women into the program, into our program, into all the apprenticeship programs, and all the coordinators are working towards that. Oregon Tradeswomen Network has actually grown quite much. They have two or three full-time staff now, where before it was part-time. The other thing we've worked up is the Oregon Construction Workforce Alliance, which is actually set up to work with CBOs, community-based organizations in the greater Portland area, to get minorities the chance to come into programs to realize they're even there. And what we found out when we deal with CBOs and the women and minorities, they don't even know it's available. They have no idea what's going on. They don't know apprenticeships around. Point in fact, we had 2 weeks ago, we had 17 young ladies from Helen's View High School came to our training center. We put them out in classes with the apprenticeship, with apprentices. They had lunch with the apprentices. We not only explained to them the sheet metal apprenticeships available, but there's electricians, carpenters, there's a whole world to them out there. These girls are all basically, and I talked to their principal on their last chance, they've all come from abusive homes or abusive relationships. She said they all have 1 to 3 children. We're working hard. We actually had 2 of them that came in and talked to us and actually are going to apply to our program. And I'm supposed to tell these young ladies that basically could possibly be on the public dole the rest of their life, that they're placed 1, 2, and 3 on the program, but they're not allowed to come in because they're not related. I don't think it's fair. We've worked very hard trying to get the women and minorities to know what's going on, to get them to apply to the program, and I think it should be taken in order, and if they are placed there, that's where they should come in. Speaking of bringing somebody's, I have a son that's not in apprenticeship, but for example, if my son wanted to get into sheet metal apprenticeship, if he applied, as Representative Gardner said, he turned out 999th on a list of 1,000. I, as an employer, could say when he comes up to the top of the list, I want to hire him. He would be hired in that order. We've been doing that for years. It's not a problem with any of our employers. So I think basically if this bill does take effect and if you do pass this, I think it's going to set apprenticeship back in the state of Oregon probably 10 years.
Thank you. Questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick O'Connor. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Building Congress. I'm mostly an educator. Our mission is the Oregon Building Congress is to try to bring a better quality and a more diverse applicant into the construction industry. We are supported by contractors and members of unions. I have been responsible for implementing programs at schools such as Jefferson, Tubman Middle School, and James John Elementary School, where there's a high minority population. And the purpose of introducing a program at these schools, which we've done in concert with companies like Portland General Electric, Northwest Natural Gas, Bonneville Power Administration, Pacific Corps, is to bring the possibility of entering apprenticeship into the minority community. This past year, when we implemented the program at Jefferson, the principal at Jefferson said to us, "We feel that because of this program, a door that had been closed to the black community has now been opened." Last Friday, I attended a retirement party for Al King, who was key in helping us put this program together at Jefferson High School. He's an African American. He's worked at PGE for 27 years. Al King is only the third minority person to retire from PGE, only the third African American in its history. Last summer, 60 Minutes did a show on women in construction, and unfortunately, the construction industry came off as Neanderthals in terms of involving women in construction. Now, we in Oregon, I think, are different. We are trying very hard, as Jerry mentioned, to bring opportunities to women. And this coming Friday, the Oregon Tradeswomen Network is going to bring 450 young ladies to the training center at the electricians, the IBEW, out on Airport Way in Portland, and show those young ladies the opportunities in the construction industry. Now, in addition to the altruism and the sense of fairness and justice that's involved in making sure that minorities and women have the opportunity to these jobs, there's also the issue of workforce. We are anticipating that there's going to be a shortage in our industry, in the construction industry, as the baby boomers begin to retire, and that there's going to be increased needs for work in infrastructure and public buildings and highways, and that we're going to need to draw on people who have traditionally not entered the construction industry. Now, I think we have a good chance of doing that with our programs, and we're also going after ESL students. By the way, this week, Newsweek magazine is going to have a wrap around each Newsweek that's going to talk about a program we have at Cleveland High School, which involves ESL students, students who come from 14 different countries who are getting interested in construction. If these students feel that they have a chance to access apprenticeship on an equal basis with other students, And if they feel that they have to meet a high standard to get in there, then we have the leverage, I think, as educators, to get these kids to make the extra effort to excel, to take advantage of these opportunities. If they, for one reason or another, see, even under the maybe the best of intentions, but if the result is, as Commissioner Roberts said, if the effect is that the door is closed to them, then we're going to destroy these programs in the schools because kids are not going to go into them, and we're going to hurt ourselves as an industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify in this bill? Yes, sign up. No one. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 791. Just a moment. Okay, I think we are going to allow this issue to be digested for a day or two, and I'll put it back on the agenda maybe later in the week. Talk about some more. Thank you very much, and we will.